I'm Pandey Sujata, and welcome to Dhamma Threads, where we spend some time to explore the suttas, the teachings of the Buddha, and to reflect and discuss and try to see how relevant and important these things are for us in our lives. And in this series of discussions, we're looking at the right view discourse, the Samadhi Sutta, Madhyama Nikaya number 9, and we're looking at that in the translation by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi in his wonderful middle-length discourses of the Buddha. So I'll read from the sutta to start with, and then we'll move into our discussion. So saying, good friend, the Bhikkhu is delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words. Then they asked him a further question. But friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma? There might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands contact, the origin of contact, the cessation of contact, and the way leading to the cessation of contact, in that way he is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma. And what is contact? What is the origin of contact? What is the cessation of contact? And what is the way leading to the cessation of contact? There are these six classes of contact, pasakaya. The eye contact, ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, and mind contact. With the arising of the sixfold base, the salayatana, there is the arising of contact. With the cessation of the sixfold base, there is the cessation of contact. The way leading to the cessation of contact is just this noble eightfold path. That is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. When a noble disciple has thus understood contact, the origin of contact, the cessation of contact, and the way leading to the cessation of contact, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust, he abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion, he extirpates the underlying tendency to the view and conceit, I am, and by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, he here and now makes an end of suffering. In that way, too, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. Okay, so this one talking about contact. So again, continuing with the analysis of sense experience and how consciousness works according to dependent origination. Right? So in the past we talked about feeling and craving, but as we're doing dependent origination in the reverse order, we're moving backwards from the, if you like, from the bigger things, right? We move back from birth or aging and death and moving and towards more and more kind of subtle things, more and more refined, more and more specific things. And this treatment of contact that we find in the suttas is actually quite interesting and quite a refined aspect of the Buddhist psychology. So here the contact is treated as the six kinds, and this is sort of following the pattern through this section of dependent origination that all of the factors here are defined in terms of these six kinds, right? So, but normally in contact, it often is defined in that way, but we also find in the context of dependent origination another analysis of contact which is very interesting, and that's found in the Mahanidana Sutta, where it analyzes contact as being two kinds. One is called Patigaha Sampasa, and the other one, adivachana sampasa. Patigaha sampasa literally means resistance contact. Okay, adivachana sampasa literally means designation contact. Now, those two words themselves don't mean a lot, or the terms. These are highly technical, psychological terms coined by the Buddha. But patigaha sampasa, resistance, essentially relates to physical contact. Right. So when we experience something through the senses, right, there's some element of resistance there. Okay, even if eye comes in and hits the eye, it strikes the eye, or more literally strikes like the rods and cones in the back of the eye and so on. Actually, there has to be some physical impact in order to register that sense contact. And similarly with the ear, when the sound comes in, or more technically, when the variations in air pressure, we call sound waves, right? When that hits the ear, it then causes a vibration in the eardrum and so on and so forth. So for any of these kinds of senses, there needs to be an actual physical impact. Right? And so this is what's been called here the patigaha sampasa. And that relates to the five physical senses. then the mental sense is called adhivachana sampasaya, designation contact, right? So by using the word designation here is referring to what we were talking about previously with the idea of language and concepts, okay? So the mind is making sense of those objects, right? So those the physical sense of hits, registers, and that's like an automatic sort of neuropsychological response, right? You can't really do much about that. But then the mind makes sense of that, and it uses language to make sense of that, adhivachana, yeah? And so the perception starts to come in, right? Perception is saying that, for example, this thing that is perceived through eye consciousness, right, is a different kind of thing than the thing perceived through ear consciousness, right? So you're able to distinguish these. And we know that if your brain wiring gets mixed up, you have synesthesia or something like that, then you can confuse those things, right? It's your mind which makes those distinctions through using this adhivachana, using these contacts. Similarly, it's your mind which, for example, when you see something and I see that door over there, my mind is the one that says the door is a separate thing than the wall. Okay? Color isn't telling me that, right? Those things, the door and the wall, exist only in the mind, right? What I see is only color. Yeah? So this is that essential difference between the padiga sampasa, again, is because its impact, it's essentially passive, right? Where we get hit by these sense contacts, whereas adhivachana sampasa is essentially active. It's how we respond in terms of creating a world that makes sense for us. Yeah? And so these kinds of contact are the very kind of edge in which experience happens, okay? Now, when it's just described in terms of infant development, right, you think about in terms of the growth of the embryo in the womb, right? And again, when the embryo is beginning, there's nothing or virtually nothing in terms of what they're aware of. Gradually, the senses start to develop. The first sense to develop, probably sense of touch, I would imagine, yeah? And then gradually, other senses start to kind of emerge and they experience contacts, right? Now, when we grow up, it's because of the contacts that we experience that we learn about the world, right? And our mind is actually nurtured through our contacts, right? This is actually something which is very important to understand, because sometimes from a Buddhist point of view, we tend to think contact is bad, right? Oh, we want to avoid contacts, we want to avoid stimulus, we want to avoid seeing things and hearing things and smelling things and tasting things and touching things, because these things are distracting, they're disturbing, they're upsetting, yeah? But without these things, we can't learn. We can't learn language. We can't learn growth. We can't learn how to love. We can't learn how to hate. We can't learn all of those things, which is where our wisdom is going to grow. And we can't learn the Dhamma. Yeah? We can only learn the Dhamma because our mind has grown in this kind of context. Yeah? And so this is why the Buddha was scathingly critical of people who argued that wisdom came about by not experiencing these things. Right? He said, well, if just not knowing things was the way to wisdom, then a little baby lying in its cot would be the wisest person in the world. Yeah? So we can't. A blind man has no more wisdom because they can't see. A deaf man has no more wisdom because they can't hear. Yeah? So sense restraint and understanding the senses and dealing with contact doesn't mean not experiencing things, right? It means that we have wisdom and mindfulness and care when we experience things. We understand that there are certain kinds of experiences that we have that lead towards what's wholesome, certain kinds of experiences that lead towards what's unwholesome, and so we cultivate them appropriately. Yeah? So this pasa is where everything comes together, the contact where the inner world of the mind and the external senses all come together, and that creates that world of experience. Yeah, I mean, that is an interesting point, and it is something that I've seen as well, that people have brought up as Buddhist children, who are brought up as Buddhists, often sort of not that interested when they grow older. I'm thinking here of mainly children in say non-traditional Buddhist families. Right? I mean, here in Australia, we sort of conventionally have this distinction between traditional Buddhist or what's often called cultural Buddhists, but I don't like that term, but I think traditional Buddhists is probably better. Traditional Buddhists, and then new Buddhists like myself who sort of discover Buddhism in their, when they're adults. But it's very much a false dichotomy, because you see within Buddhist, traditional Buddhist communities, there are many people who only actually really discover Buddhism in their adult life anyway, right? They maybe sort of were conventionally Buddhist, but it never had any meaning for them, and they find it much later in life. But also because we've now reached a point in, certainly in Australian culture, where there's quite a few people who are brought up who are like second generation Western Buddhists, right? So their parents were Buddhist for decades, and they're now being brought up as Buddhist children. And because in, generally speaking, in Australian culture, the parents usually don't try to, it's a bit hard to generalize, but often the parents don't try to sort of determine what a child's religion might be. You know, so for example, when I decided to become an atheist originally, you know, my parents were like, oh, whatever, you know, it wasn't like it was a big deal, you know, we talked about it a bit and so on, but yeah, that's fine, it's your choice, yeah. And when kids, you know, get into their teens, especially their late teens, they make their own choices, and often they may not choose to become a Buddhist or call themselves a Buddhist, and that's kind of okay. Or they, you know, they go off and do other things. And but also it happens within traditional Buddhist families, I find, as well, that, you know, when they really value the importance of bringing their children up as Buddhists. But of course, this thing of contact, isn't it, right? So within a traditional Buddhist community, you're sort of surrounded by Buddhist contact, yeah? Every village you go to in Sri Lanka, there's a Buddha image there, and there's a temple everywhere, and there's monks everywhere, and so on. Whereas if you're in Australia, you've got lots of other kinds of contacts, yeah? Non-Buddhist contacts, and things which are drawing you in other directions. So it is actually a problem in some communities in Australia. It's a bigger problem in some communities than others. For example, in Australia, in the Sri Lankan community, it's handled quite well, because the Sri Lankans in Australia are usually very well educated. They usually have very good English, and so they have quite good Dhamma programs for educating the kids, right? Whereas, for example, let's say in the Burmese community, it's often like from a refugee background. Parents often not so well educated, don't have very good English. Can't communicate with their children and communicate with their Dhamma about their children. Sorry, can't communicate with their children about Dhamma particularly. And so they're very worried, because they feel that their children are growing up without any Dhamma knowledge or background whatsoever. Yeah? But even in that case where you can bring the children up with some Dhamma background, they're not necessarily going to take that up and decide, I'm going to live with it. And they grow up and they're Australians and they have their own ideas and they question things, and that's okay. And but I think one thing to bear in mind is that the Dhamma will only become meaningful when you've experienced that kind of suffering in your life, right? And that you're looking for some answer. And when does that happen? Well, it happens to different people in different ways, right? You can't determine that. Some people it happens when they're young, and that's fine. A lot of people it happens when they're older. And so you can't expect that to really be the case. But if you do have that Dhamma education from when kids are younger, what it means is that when they have that suffering and they're looking for something, right, they know that there's something there. Maybe they haven't had any contact with Buddhism for 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, and then something happens. They need that sense of meaning, but then the teachings will come back, and then they'll start to look again. So this is why when people come and they're sort of worried, I said, don't worry about it. Let your children make their own choices. Let them make their own life. When they need the Dhamma, they know where the Dhamma is and they can come looking. Saying, good friends, the bhikkhus delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words. Then they asked him a further question. But friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma? Sariputta replied, there might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands the sixfold base, the salayatana, the origin of the sixfold base, the cessation of the sixfold base, and the way leading to the cessation of the sixfold base, in that way he is one of right view who has arrived at this true Dhamma. And what is the sixfold base? What is the origin of the sixfold base? What is the cessation of the sixfold base? And what is the way leading to the cessation of the sixfold base? There are these six bases: the eye base, ear base, nose base, tongue base, body base, and mind base. With the arising of mentality, materiality, there is the arising of the sixfold base. With the cessation of mentality, materiality, there is the cessation of the sixfold base. The way leading to the cessation of the sixfold base is just this noble eightfold path. That is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. When a noble disciple has thus understood the sixfold base, the origin of the sixfold base, the cessation of the sixfold base, and the way leading to the cessation of the sixfold base, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust. He abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion. He extirpates the underlying tendency to the view and conceit, I am. And by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, he here and now makes an end of suffering. In that way, too, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. Okay, so I'll give a bit of a discussion about this passage, and then we can move on to have a chat about it. So, first thing to notice is the term that the Venerable Bodhi is using here, the sixfold base. Now, I really don't like this translation. I think it's kind of meaningless Buddhist hybrid English, and it's a bit kind of ugly, and it doesn't really translate what it's actually about. But it's not an easy one to find a better translation. This is the problem. It's easy to criticize the translation. It's not so easy to find one that actually works better. As usual, when reading Venerable Bodhi's translations, it's important to understand that he is trying to ensure that the technical terms are used with as much consistency as possible in different contexts. Okay? And so sometimes you have to sort of pick a word that might not work entirely well in any context, but can be kind of fitted into all of them with a greater or lesser degree of precision, right? But if you're able to choose it, particularly in each individual context, you might choose something more specific. Now, the word six, obviously, is fairly unproblematic. But the word ayatana is the problem here, base. Now, it's from the root meaning of ayatana is something which is spread out. Okay? So something like a field, right? Sometimes they're translated as a sphere or arena, yeah? Something like that. Right? So a field, a sense field, yeah? Perhaps that's maybe what I would think of as better translations, a sense field. But really it just means the six senses. And it's considered, you have, of course, the Dwadasayatanani, the 12-fold sense fields or sense bases, which is both the inner and the outer sense fields or sense bases, i.e. the eye and forms, the ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and taste, body and touches, mind and dhammas, right? So it's both the inner and the outer. And our senses only operate in this kind of duality, right? There's always that kind of duality. There's a structure to experience. This is very, very important. Experience cannot work without some kind of structure, right? Why? Well, because it's that structure and that division that gives an energy and attention to things, right? Without the energy and the tension, there's no activity, right? Consciousness is an activity, and there has to be something to stimulate that activity, right? You think about that, right? I remember times when I've been sitting meditation, right? And I'm sitting meditation maybe in front of a window, and you sit for quite a long time, and your mind becomes quite peaceful and so on. Now, what happens when I meditate is that I close my eyes to meditate. But as my mind becomes peaceful, my eyelids gradually open a little bit, right? But I don't notice it. Okay, I don't realize that my eyes have opened because I'm not paying attention. And sometimes it happened when I remember when I was sitting in Bodhnyana in Perth, and my eyes would kind of open, and then suddenly this kangaroo would jump in front of where I was sitting, and I'd leap up. I had no idea that my eyes were open. Right? And it's not until there's movement, right? There's some activity that gives you a stimulus that the consciousness actually starts to work, right? So that the consciousness depends on this tension, yeah? That gives it an energy that allows the energy to actually work and the consciousness to manifest. Yeah? So this is what's happening with these things, the sense, the inner and the outer sense space. It takes the pair of them to make consciousness actually happen. So to me, using perhaps the word field or something may be better. You think of like a sense field. You think of each sense as being in some way kind of like an arena or a spectrum, right? Which makes consciousness possible, right? And it makes consciousness of that particular kind possible. Yeah? Now, all of these six senses are completely different kinds of things. Right? Again, just to think and reflect about that, might say sight, for example. Right? Sight has the characteristic of being, first of all, extremely vivid. Right? When we see things, they're very clear. There's a lot of different colours, a lot of definition in it. We can identify things very easily, and so on. Yeah? It also has the characteristic of being located, right? So it feels, relative to our body, it's kind of in front of us, yeah? And the field of vision has a certain shape to it. It has a kind of oval shape that kind of disappears towards the edges and so on. So it has all of these characteristics, yeah? Sound, for example, doesn't have those characteristics, yeah? Sound isn't located in the same precise way that sight is, right? It's kind of located, but much more vaguely, yeah? Smell, for example, is hardly located at all, right? When you smell something, you just know that it's around. You don't know where it is. It has a very different kind of qualities to that of sight and that of sound and so on. There's a wonderful sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha called the Chapana Sutta, with the six animals. And he said it's as if you would take I can't remember what the animals were now. It was a crocodile, a bird, a dog, a snake, and a fish and a jackal or something like that, and you tie them all together in one bundle and leave them there, right? That's what our six senses are, yeah? It's just this conglomerate of these entirely random kinds of information. I mean, it's interesting to think whether it would be possible to have different kinds of senses, for example. What if we could detect, say, radio waves? Yeah? What if we could be like bats and detect sonar? Yeah? Or what if we could detect gravity, for example? Yeah? Or I don't know what else there might be, yeah? That we could use to detect. Perhaps that might be possible, but certainly in the creatures that we know of, most of the time these six senses are very prominent. There might be a few exceptions to that, but mostly it's the six senses that are very prominent. So with these external five senses, we take the information that they give us, all of the disparate information, and the mind makes a world out of a world which we imbue with meaning. Yeah? Sight gives us a bunch of colours. We say this colour is a person. There's motion and a certain part of that person. We call that part in the mouth. It's moving. There's a sound that's coming into our ears. And we make an association between that sound and that movement. We say, oh, that person is talking. Yeah? That's not something, we don't see that with our senses, right? Our external senses never see a person talking. The eyes just see colour, the ears hear sounds, and it's our mind that creates this idea of a person talking. Now that's what senses have to do, right? It's we have to live in a world that makes sense, right? But the problem is that we misapprehend that. Right? Rather than actually understanding what the process is going in, we live inside that, we get taken. It's as if we're living inside a virtual reality existence. I should correct myself. It's not as if we're living inside a virtual reality existence. We are living inside a virtual reality existence. Yeah, the reality that we're concocting in our mind is just our own reality. It's purely our subjective meaning that we've given to it. It's similar enough to other people's subjective meaning that we can get by much of the time, right? That's what we mean when we call something an objective fact, right? There's no such thing as an objective fact, right? An objective fact is simply when you can get a bunch of people to agree subjectively that it is an objective fact, right? Actually, they each have their own perfectly subjective truth, yeah? But together, we come and we say, okay, we'll call this an objective fact, yeah, because we've all agreed on it. Yeah. In fact, reality is always subjective, and it's always derived from these senses. So in this way, Buddhism as a philosophy has been described, and I think quite accurately, by the great Sri Lankan philosophers, Jayatilaka and following him David Kalapahana, they describe the Buddha as an empiricist. Yeah? And so an empirical philosopher is one who derives their vision of the world, or derives their description and their understanding of the world by staying close to experience. Right? This to me is the essence of what an empiricism is. Now, in Western philosophy, there were basically two kinds of schools of philosophers. The rationalists, which was exemplified by Plato and his school, who said that we can't trust our senses, right? Because our senses can be misleading, right? Sometimes you see a person and you think it's a man, actually it's a woman, right? So how do we know what our senses are telling us, right? So because we can't trust our senses, therefore, how do we find the truth? So Plato said, well, there are some things we can know absolutely. For example, we can know that 1 + 1 = 2. Yeah? And I can know that with more certainty than I can know that there are 2 apples in this basket. Right? You can give me 2 apples in a basket. Maybe one of them is a very cleverly disguised pear. Yeah? Maybe there's another apple which is hidden somewhere in a secret compartment in the basket. Our senses can always deceive us, yeah? But 1 + 1 = 2 is an absolute, timeless, perfect truth that I can never be confused about or never get wrong, yeah? So this is the argument from the rationalist point of view, that we can derive our idea of the truth from first principles and from reason. And in the suttas, these kinds of philosophers are called taki vimangsa, yeah? Vimangsaka. They are the ones who derive their understanding of truth through pure reason. Now, in Western philosophy, that pure reason school was dominant for 1,000 years or more, and began to be challenged around the time, slowly began to be challenged, actually, with the reintroduction of Aristotelian philosophy around the 11th and 12th centuries, as Aristotelian philosophy was rediscovered from the Arabs, but more aggressively from like the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries with the Renaissance and then the Enlightenment and the great empiricist philosophers like David Hume and so on. The idea, the argument which the empiricist philosophers would bring against the rationalists, it's a complex argument, but to place it very simply, is that these ideas which the rationalists regarded as absolutely truth, absolutely true by first principles, they don't in fact exist by first principles. That's just a delusion, right? The very ideas that they're talking about are derived from sense experience originally, right? The very fact that we can have the idea of the number one and the idea of the number two is because we've seen examples in experience of one and two, and we've developed a language that can talk about it, and from there we've abstracted these ideas. So these ideas, the fact that these ideas are so certain and so precise, doesn't tell us that they're absolutely true. It merely tells us that we can create perfectly and clearly defined concepts. Yeah? And so that perfection of concepts about things is the hallmark of the rationalist philosophers, as opposed to the empiricists. So the empiricists come back to experience and they say, let's base our idea of truth by sticking close to the facts, right? Now, it's important to understand, by sticking close to direct experience, it's important to understand that you can never stay entirely with only direct experience, right? We always must infer some things, right? But that inference must be checked, it must be tested, and it must be as close as possible to the actual facts, yeah? And so this is where you started to get, for example, in the West, say someone like Galileo, who said, measure it. If you can't measure it, make it measurable. Right? And that's kind of the essence of empiricism. Yeah? And some of David Hume came along, the English empiricist philosopher, who said that if you look into your own mind, right, and you investigate what is actually happening in your mind, you will see thoughts, and you will see memories, and you will see perceptions, and you will see changes, but you will never see anything which is yourself. Right? And you can investigate for as long as you like, and you will never find yourself inside your own mind. Yeah? And he said, and as true and as obvious as that is, I can guarantee you that once you have done this exercise, got up from your seat and walked off, 5 minutes later you will have completely forgotten that and will act as if you still have a self. Yeah? Yeah? Very true. Unfortunately, David Hume hadn't learned Buddhist meditation, in which case he maybe would have changed his mind about that. That's precisely the function of mindfulness, is to not forget that fact. Yeah? So this is that idea of empiricism. Okay, I don't want to go too much into the history and into the Western philosophy, but just to notice that there is that similarity, those parallels of ideas, right? So the Buddha's ideas was always to stay close to experience as possible. Keep checking and keep testing it against what is your actual experience. Yeah? What's actually happening through these six senses. So the six senses are not regarded as being something which are entirely reliable, okay? And this is another important point. Because obviously they can be delusory, and the Buddha used this kind of imagery. You know, he said it's like a mirage or like a dream and so on. So yes, of course, they can mislead us as to what they represent, okay? But they still are true in what they are, okay? When we see a door, maybe it's not a door, maybe it's a painted shape which looks like a door, right? But it is a sight, right? It is colour, right? And that's not delusory. So there's something about that experience which remains close to reality. From a Buddhist point of view, unlike Plato and the Western philosophical tradition, which is always looking for some notion of absolute truth, okay? Absolute truth. How do we find the true with a capital T, okay? And again, a similarity between Buddhism and the empiricist philosopher. The empiricists admit that it's not necessarily possible to find a truth with a capital T, yeah? But it is possible to find a truth that is good enough, yeah? And that is the kind of truth that science is based on, okay? Again, to come to Galileo, measure it. If you can't measure it, make it measurable. Well, you can never measure anything 100% precisely, right? It's always within some degree of approximation. There's always a bit of wiggle room there, right? No matter how precise your instruments are. Yeah? The point is not, is it perfect? The point is it good enough? Yeah? If I want to measure the distances between two pieces of steel, and I want to keep these two pieces of steel in parallel, I can say they're 1 meter apart here. 10 meters further on, they're also 1 meter apart. Actually, they're a fraction of a millimeter out. That doesn't really matter. The point is, can a train run on them? Yeah? And if the train runs, that's true enough. Yeah? That's scientific truth. Buddhist truth is exactly the same. So from a Buddhist point of view, it doesn't matter whether we formulate the Dhamma and it's absolutely precise and whether every detail is there. What's important is it good enough to be able to let go of suffering? Right? That's the point. It's a pragmatic understanding of truth. Right? So what we get through the senses, we don't care is that perfectly reliable and perfectly true all the time. What we care about is it good enough for us to be able to let go? Right? Is it good enough for us to be able to find peace? Yeah? That's the truth that really matters.